Welcome to the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, taking you around the country, shedding light on the work of the Scottish FA from grassroots to coach development, and taking a look at the future of our game.
In this episode, your host Lewis Irons sits down with Head of Coach Education and Development Greg Patterson and Tampa Bay Rowdies Head Coach Neil Collins.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for joining me. Greg, this has got to be geographically one of the widest ranging podcasts we've had the pleasure of doing with Neil Collins joining us from Tampa. Neil, thank you very much for joining us. It's a pleasure to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to hear some familiar voices and a Scottish accent never gets old.
Greg, it seems like in the last few that we've recorded from isolation that we've had to address the current situation. We've almost got like a coronavirus section of the podcast at the start. And I mean, we might have a wee chuckle and a laugh about it, but it's a serious matter. And we're lucky in this instance to have one in another country to give us insight into how clubs and players and managers are dealing with things. But a current head coach, of course, of the Tampa Bay Rowdies. So it's going to be insightful to hear from.
Yeah, it's great to have Neil and myself, Andy and Malky. We're fortunate enough to visit Neil two Januaries ago. And we were over at the USC convention. We spent some time, we spent a day there in camp with Neil, which was excellent. So, no, it's great to have him. It's just, it just goes to show perhaps the power of social media at this time. You're right, it is a, you know, we do maybe have a laugh and joke about the situation we're in at present, but you know, you see probably a lot of people being a little bit more active on social media, and that's probably the reason Neil and I got in touch over the last week or so to then set this up and just get that opportunity. And
absolutely, Neil, and the latest installment of my coaching journey, we're going to get right on into things, but to start off with, can you give us a bit of a taste of how things are out in the States at the moment, not just for yourself personally and your family, of course, but as a head coach of a football club out there?
Yeah, I mean, from a personal point of view, I think it's very similar to you guys. I don't want to rub it in, but having the sun here 24/7 certainly helped from trying to manage the kids, you know, been out in the bikes, got my daughter to learn how to ride her bike. So These small things have been a positive. From a coach's point of view, no different to any other coach. It's tough trying to make the best of a bad situation. It's given me a chance for the first time in a couple of years, I think, since, you know, meeting up with Greg and Andy. That was me right at the start of getting into this job. And this has given me a little chance to reflect, a little chance to slow down. But even then, trying to do the best we can in a bad situation by keeping in contact with the players, trying to make their life as easy as possible. So I've spoke to a number of coaches and we're all doing the same things, and it's not easy, but it's definitely a learning experience.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to ask Neil the question, but Greg, would you trade the beaches of Troon for the beaches of Tampa, would you?
I've seen where he lives. It's magnificent. And funnily enough, Neil's actually a Troon boy himself. Neil's from Troon, but that's not a link at all. I didn't know Neil until I met up with him last January, although I do when I'm involved with my little boys team here in Troon, I do get it rammed down my throat that I think Neil and Craig Sampson were part of the last Scottish Cup winning team from Troon.
Oh yeah,
Neil was maybe under.
I think the last and the only.
Yeah, well, Neil, let's before we kind of get into the coaching side of things, I know that's what we're here to talk about. You've obviously got such an illustrious playing career to talk about. Was there a point in your playing career, Neil, that you can pinpoint as being a moment where you thought about coaching, or did you always have it in your mind?
You know, I think I was brought up loving football, go watch my home team at Kilmarnock, and my dad took my own team that Greg just mentioned, Troon Thistle. And I think because there was an environment with football, I always kind of considered coaching. You know, saw the way my dad took the team and how he approached things, and my other coaches. I was exposed to the coach education quite early. At 16, 17, I did the running for a group of coaches that have all went on to have great careers: Peter Grant, Derek McInnes, John Robertson. So even then, I was watching how they would put their sessions together, how they would interact with us as young players. So honestly, I would probably say I was a coach that played more than a player that became a coach. So it's always been in my mind, and throughout my career, I always took it, you know, took a close eye on the coaches that I worked for. So, and I think being late into the full-time game at Sunderland at 20, which is late in comparison to guys that were in the academies at 16, I was considering it, if I didn't make it as a full-time, you know, player, you know, balancing part-time football with coaching, you know, in the grassroots level. And, you know, I don't mean thankfully I didn't have to do that. I was, you know, my dream was to play football, but I would have been happy to go down that route and start my coaching at that age.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Greg, right, Neil, you kind of tried the university background, and that was before your Sunderland days. Is that right? Were you not a student at Jordan Hill at Strathclyde Uni there?
Yeah, you know, again, that probably where my coaching kind of journey started. Yeah, I went to Jordan Hill and did the B.Ed. You know, I think it's called Sports Education now. It was Sport in the Community at the time.
Sport in the Community. That's right. Yeah, so funnily enough, it's the course I did. We're kind of cross transferring here a lot of things, but that's the course I did. Yeah, so I remember you were maybe a couple of years below me, showing my age now, and then disappeared.
That's right. I mean, I did 3 years there, and I'm sure you had the same kind of course tutors and lecturers, and I actually learned some great things there that stood me in good stead when I did start getting back into the coaching, you know, just the basics of coaching. Yeah. Having to take a dance session on a Wednesday morning after travelling back from Brecon on a Tuesday night.
That was your strength, the dance session. That was your strength, the dance sessions.
Oh, yeah, that was not highlight.
You spoke about some of the coaches that you worked under, Neil, as a player, and before we kind of get to your coaching in particular, are there any stories or moments that you can remember as a player working under coaches that made you think, yeah
I could tell you, I could be here a long time telling you some stories about the coaches. I'll try and tell you some of the better ones, and I think I was very fortunate to play with great coaches at Queen's Park, you know, as an under kind of 16, 18, you know, guys like Bobby Dixon, Michael Jameson, Graham Ogley, great impact. But, and then John McCormack gave me my debut, and that was a real, you know, eye-opener into professional football. But I look back and he was great for me, and he was tough on me, but just, again, made me realise just how important professional football is and what it means to people. But I think Mick McCarthy was the person at Sunderland that signed me, and his impact was huge. And you speak to anyone that's played under him, they have such respect for him, and it's because he's very, very open and honest. And I think the biggest story, the best story I could say is probably going there on trial. I'd been in trial as a player, you know, while I was at Dumbarton, at Rangers, at Charlton, at Kilmarnock, at Dundee United. And I think all these clubs and coaches looked at me as like, okay, why is someone else not taking him? Why is he's playing at Dumbarton? These other teams have looked at him. Why have they not taken him? Well, let's just, you know, just let's wait and be more patient. Whereas Mick, I just felt, brought me in, watched me from his own eyes, his own judgments, wasn't bothered about why another Scottish team hadn't taken me, and he continued to repeat that through his management. He was able to bring in players like Michael Kightley from the Conference, George Ellacobe from lower leagues, and then these guys went on and played in the Premier League for him, and he got them for nothing, and he worked on them just because he just trusted his own judgment. And that was a big thing for me. I just felt someone as high profile as him managing the World Cup, didn't matter that I'd played at Dumbarton and I was coming out of university, he saw something that he thought he could improve and it could help his team. And that was a big learning curve for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. And Greg, when we look at that from a coaching perspective, that's a lesson in itself for a lot of guys that are maybe finding their way in the game, that haven't been able to obviously identify good players, but obviously give players belief and motivation is a huge part of coaching. It sounds simple when you say it, but
Neil's got a fantastic story, hasn't he? It's a different story, as he said. He wasn't, you know, he wasn't necessarily in a full-time academy, you know, at that kind of 16, 17, 18-year-old that, you know, most people think they should be, and if they're not, then it's all over for them. But as I say, Neil's got a fantastic story there, and you know, and that probably continues throughout his career right into coaching now. And it's interesting, again, I'm talking about other podcasts we've had, Lewis, but, you know, you talk about, you know, maybe resilience that we spoke about with Don McNaughton in a previous episode, you know, and there's, you know, Neil's probably had to develop that resilience and those knockbacks. I mean, he rhymed off, what, half a dozen clubs there?
Yeah. And as a player, Neil, did you always, obviously, as a player, as a centre-back, and as your role on the park, you had to be a leader. So did you always maybe think you had that attribute that would make your transition into coaching, not easy, but certainly a natural step for you?
Yeah. You know, again, it's interesting because I think you guys will know leaders come in many shapes and sizes, and that's something that I learned through my career. You know, Greg just mentioned there about belief. I did have belief. I also just had a complete and utter, you know, ignorance at times, which youth brings. You know, being at university, people would say, what are you going to do? And I'd just say, well, I'm going to try and be a professional footballer. And I think, look back now, that type, almost naive, but that was a strength. And as I went on, you know, I was myself. The character I was just being myself. And that, you know, whether people think that was a leader or not, I think at times it is, and you know, at times you have to adapt. So I've played with some great captains, absolutely some fantastic captains, led by the way they played, led by the way they acted. Harry Maguire, who I was very fortunate to play with, now the captain of Manchester United, totally different type of character. Just, he's developed into, you know, one of the best leaders, but not a shouter, not a screamer, but just leads by example and leads by the way he plays. Equally, I've played with guys that were great leaders, but haven't been on to be great coaches or great managers, yeah, because it's a different type of leadership at times. And that's something that a lot of people have played with me have asked me, do you go mad? And I'm saying, of course I don't. I don't go mad, you know, very, very rarely do I go mad, because that's not how people are going to respond. Yeah. Are going to respond to me. So I've realised that, you know, it's a different type of leadership, and it's a different type of example that you need to set as a manager or a coach, as a captain. And I think I was aware of that, and I've tried to implement that.
That's a great point to make, isn't it, Greg? But not maybe for the coaches listening, but for maybe people that don't have maybe as much of an insight into the coaching world, that your average Joe might look at, you know, the guy that shouts and balls in a park and think, oh, he'll be a good coach one day, but it doesn't always translate. And that's a good point to point out to people that maybe don't see that side of it.
When you talk about shouting and bawling, I've nowhere near the playing experience that Neil's had, but I remember when I was a kid at Celtic, you know, in an old-fashioned schoolboy form, and I remember getting shouted and bawled at by a coach who should probably remain nameless, because he was shouting and bawling at me. But, you know, and then in the second half I scored two goals, and then he says to me at the end, remind me to shout and bawl at you every game or every half time. Do you know what? It wasn't the shouting and bawling. In fact, the shouting and bawling acted the other way for me. I would have went kind of inwardly with it and shied away from that, whereas other people, you know, I was, you know, I played with some guys in that team, would have went the other way and reacted to that shouting ball, and I was the opposite, and it probably turned me off for, you know, for even a couple of weeks after that, even though, you know, I did score those two goals in the second half that I remember. But yeah, you're right, people react in different ways, and it's that I suppose, talent and ability. You know, you talk about, you know, we're talking about leaders just now, and we're talking about, you know, Neil mentioned leading by example, which is one way to lead. You know, that shouting ball might be somebody's way of leading, and we've all come across them. But,
yeah,
you know, somebody might be a bit of a, you know, might be able to mix and match those attributes as well, and know how to manage people better. And I suppose is that maybe the most successful people we're getting now, that man management, that they know who needs a cuddle, and they know who needs the shouting and bawling as well.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, I mean, like you guys do, I'm sure we all read different articles, pick up different things, and you heard recently that Wayne Rooney looks back now and Alex Ferguson was tough on him because he knew he could handle it, and never shouted at Nanny because he knew that he wouldn't get the best out of him. And that's something that straight away, you know, as a young coach, I've had to learn and adapt to working with people from different cultures. You know, we come from a culture that we are used to certain things and a way of speaking to people and a way of reacting to things. But someone from maybe America or Jamaica or Canada is not, and that's not to pigeonhole them, but it's just to say that you know, they do react differently to different things, and their motivations maybe not how we're motivated. So that's been a big learning curve for me. And going back to people I worked under, you know, for coaches, Danny Wilson was a guy that managed over 1,000 games, and And what always really impressed me with him was how calm he was in adversity. You know, things that happen off the field. You know, we had the Ched Evans case going on through a whole season. I ended up in a real tough time with my son being in hospital for 3 weeks, you know, during a real tough point in the season. But he just kept his calm. And for me as a player, that gave me so much confidence that a leader that can stay as calm like that in difficult circumstances, again, can inspire you. So, again, it was just a lesson to me that people are inspired a lot by different things, not always just a great speech.
No, of course. Yeah, and your playing career, you know, over 500 odd club appearances, and a lot of that, of course, in the UK, but then you did make that step and you transitioned across the pond, if you like. And was it a bit of a shock to you, the difference in culture? How do you summarise the difference?
It was. I think I was prepared for it, but not. The reality was even more different. Again, just a type of player that hadn't been through the professional upbringing that we're used to. These guys have been to college, so they're highly educated, which gives you a different type of person. And then on top of that, you've got the football landscape. The passion's there, but it's a different type of passion to the one we're used to from our fans and from our media. So all these things were different, but that's why I took the opportunity, was to try and see things from a different perspective and experience things from a different perspective. And, you know, again, I use our fans, for example. They're so positive. They're so behind us. You come off after a game when you get beaten and you know it's not good enough, but they're trying to look at the positives, which was different. And then just interacting with the coaches and the players was different. But again, that's why I came, was to get that insight.
Yeah. And Greg, you mentioned at the top of this that you were fortunate enough to go across and visit Neil with a few of the guys and be in that setup. And we had a talk, an in-depth chat on the podcast, of course, after you came back from the United Soccer Coaches Convention. Yeah. But a bit of insight into what that was like going over and being around with Neil over there.
I think at the time, Neil will correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think at the time Neil was just building. You know, he just appointed his kind of management team, if you like. Well, we're lucky the owner was around the place that day as well, and we get, you know, maybe half an hour of his time as well. We were just literally bumping into people round about the stadium in the area as Neil took us round things, and obviously having a chat with him, just catching up because we were close by. So, no, it was fantastic just seeing how Neil was putting things together there, what his plans were, talking about his plans for the forthcoming season. And now he's in this, you know, one season later, he's in this situation where, you know, he's encountering something. We all are. We're encountering something for the first time, but how he adapts to that. And Neil and I have been in touch as well. I know, you know, he's got a new backroom staff there, or some of the staff have changed slightly on you know, compared to the guys I met last year. So, you know, things keep evolving all the time as well, and then I suppose you're railroaded with this. But the American, you know, for Neil to go over there and get that experience is just it's just fantastic. Yeah.
Talk to us, Neil, about that moment. Of course, you arrive in Tampa as a player and then you do become the manager. What was that moment like? I'm assuming that you had a great relationship with everyone at the club and made that transition as manager before you, as it could be, given it was your first job.
It was honestly really surreal looking back. You got a guy like Joe Cole, who I developed a great friendship with as a player. All of a sudden, I'm going to have to tell him at some point or other, you know, he's not playing, or I'm going to take him off, or I need him to do better. Marcel Schaefer, German international, you know, one of Wolfsburg's greatest ever appearance makers, you know. Then just the other players that I've been roommates with, I've been travel companions with, the staff. You know, I'm looking at two guys that are goalkeeping coach and assistant manager that are probably wondering where they stand. And you try to be as transparent and as honest as possible in your first dealings with them, but you know it's going to just be over time. You know, again, the same with the players. Players will talk great games on buses after games or in training sessions about what they would do, but actually doing it day after day. So I go back, I look back and think I handled certain things really well, and there's other things that I would maybe do differently. But again, that's the whole point of the experience. But the players did make it as easy as possibly could, because it was as difficult for them as it might be for me. You know, again, you're having to make some difficult decisions. But the biggest thing I tried to do was be as open and upfront you know, as I could be, and not hide behind any old relationships. You know, we had a guy there, Georgi Ristov, leading goal scorer, all time kind of club legend, someone that I had a great relationship with. But that was, you know, these are the tough things when you had to come to make decisions on whether to keep them long term or not. You know, the easy things to keep them, the hard things to make the hard decision, not keeping them, but knowing that that's what's going to make us successful as a club. Those were the real tough things to do. You know, going from a player to that in the space of 2 or 3 months was difficult.
Yeah, I can imagine when, as a player, all you're really thinking about, correct me if I'm wrong, but you're mostly thinking about the next match, next change session. You're in a routine. A manager, all of a sudden, you're having to deal with people at board level, you're having to deal with players, you're having to deal with, you know, fixtures coming at you thick and fast. You must have looked at that initially and thought, God.
I think you're right. I mean, again, as a player, you don't realise how selfish you are as a player until you are in the coaching staff. Because as a player, you really are. Like, you focus very much on how you prepare, how you train, how you recover. And that's it. And if you do a good job of that, that's what will sustain yourself as a playing career. As a coach, there's obviously, like you just mentioned there, I mean, you've got the travel to take care of, the training to take care of. You've got all the people in the building to try and deal with and interact with and communicate with. You've got videos to watch. You've got, you know, teams to scout. That's honestly why I wanted the job. I really enjoy all those aspects of it. I love dealing with people. I love trying to get the best out of people. But again, it's trying to put your ideas in and seeing what ones work and what ones don't and learning quickly. And obviously, if you keep forcing the ones that are not working, that's when you've got problems. But that's what I was, why I wanted the job. That's why I took the job and gave up a playing career, is because I just was ready to start making those decisions about silly things like, are we going to eat in the hotel? Are we going to eat out? Where are we going to train? When are we going to train? That's what I wanted to use all my years of playing experience to start putting that to try and seeing if it worked. And that's been really exciting part of the job. That's why I love the job, you know, getting to make those decisions.
And how did that job come about, Neil? Did the previous manager leave? Did you apply for it? Did the owner ask you to take it? How did that all come about?
Again, it was a real, real surreal point. The team wasn't doing great. We'd had, I think, 6 away games, 4 or 5 in the bench. We hadn't scored a goal. Some really poor defeats. The dressing room wasn't great. Not so much the senior players, because, like Lewis just said, we'd been through the course. We knew, you know, how it worked. Mm-hmm. The young players were struggling, and I think the owner spoke to Joe. He had a close relationship with Joe, and asked Joe, and Joe, through many, many months and many hours sitting talking to me, decided to say that, you know, he felt I was the best candidate for the job. Short term, and I think a couple other people at the club said the same, unbeknownst to me at the time. So after a disappointing result, I got a phone call to meet the owner the next day from the president. And in the meeting, I had about a bus journey home, which was 4 hours. Woke up at 6 in the morning, put something together. And after an hour and a half meeting, you know, with the owner, he ended up offering me the job on a permanent basis. So it was as quick as that and as strange as that. Wasn't a situation I expected to be in. But again, when your first job comes up, it kind of, you never know when it's going to be and how you can prepare for it. I'm sure it was a surprise for everyone, a surprise for me, but then just head first into it.
It's an incredible story, really, isn't it, Greg? Because whether you got that job or not, Neil, after meeting, the fact that you were considered must have been a representation of how you handled yourself as a player and as a leader amongst that squad. And that speaks volumes, doesn't it, Greg, of the individual and the qualities that Neil has.
It's funny you say that. Myself and other coach head managers, Doogie and Richie, were actually talking earlier on. We were talking just about assignment submissions. And we were laughing before we came on here about Craig Sampson's submissions. And you can actually tell from the submissions, the way they handled themselves with that kind of thing, you can actually tell what they're going to be like as a coach. Now, that might sound bizarre, but from the moment somebody applies for one of our coaching courses, you can almost second guess what they're going to be like throughout the duration of the course. Brian Ewing, who does a lot of our physical preparation work on our licence courses, Brian talks about trying to be that 24/7 professional. And I think that's what, you know, that's what Neil and yourself, Lewis, are alluding to, that, you know, it's important that you try and attain that professional 24/7. You can't just be a professional the minute you walk in the club and then go back to being a slovenly bandit the minute you walk out. You know, you've got to be, I think, that 24/7 professional that will stand you in good stead throughout, and obviously gave, by the sounds of it, certainly gave Neil the opportunity it gave him.
Yeah, and then Neil, presumably when you are given that job and it's made official, the cogs start going and you are all of a sudden 24/7, you're non-stop, you're thinking about it, you're going to bed, sleeping, waking up, thinking about it. Was it an infectious start? Was it something that you just, you know, took into with that passion, desire, because it was ultimately that dream, getting that first job in, as a head coach?
Absolutely. You know, absolutely. And people still ask me, do you enjoy it? I mean, I absolutely love it. I think, you know, just touching back on, you know, I got the job and it was a surprise to many people. But the people that worked with me or had seen me said, it might be a surprise to them, but they don't know you. We know you. You know, it's not a surprise to the people that are around you. I had been doing as much coaching as I possibly could. I'd, another Scottish coach out here, Stuart Sharp, does the US men's national team, Paralympic team, and I'd been invited along to coach with them. I used to drive an hour a day to go and coach a high school team over the off season. So I think things like that, went positively for me when I got the job, and that's what made me as prepared as I possibly could be. And then the minute I took it, yeah, it was straight into it, and, you know, signing players, picking teams, picking formations, putting the training together. I mean, that was exactly everything I wanted, and still that's what I still thrive on today, and that's what's tough in this, you know, this current situation, is the fact that I'm not getting to deal with the players and not in to prepare for a game and scout opposition and, you know, relive our own game, and then, you know, these are all the things that you want to be a coach for. And the ultimate is, again, is getting out there on a Saturday and seeing how all the work comes together. That's the thing that replaces the high of being a player, is the actual game day and seeing how all your work comes together. And when it does, it's great. And when it doesn't, it's really low. But then it's about, right, why did that not work? How do we put it right again for the next week? And it's as close to being a player as it possibly can be. And it's definitely an enjoyable one.
Yeah, because when we've been doing these podcasts, Neil, we've spoke to various guys about it, and it seems like comfortably that anyone that's been a player and a coach says the highs as a coach are higher, but the lows are lower. Like the lows, you feel it that bit more, and I'm sure you've touched on it there. It must be a challenge to make sure that you don't let it affect you as a person, but mostly as a coach, because that cliche in football, the next game is just around the corner, you have to be ready for it.
I mean, that's where the first 2 or 3 months were really, really tough. You know, tough enough to just get into the day-to-day being a head coach. But on top of that, the results were varied, and we experienced a lot off the field. You know, just like any coach does, but I think you get times where things are going a little bit better than others. We had serious injuries to 3 players. We had off the field, a couple of off the field incidents. So that was a real baptism of fire to be dealing with. You know, we had to, I think, sign something like 8 or 9 players over 2 or 3 month period because of injuries and because of retirement. 2 guys retired. You know, Marcel Schaefer went back to Wolfsburg to be their sporting director. He was our best player. You know, so these were things that, you know, again, the president and owner were very understanding about and said, like, you know, we've never had an experience like this in the last 5 years, and you're going through it as a young coach. But you know what? It made me better for it. You know, and like just you said there, you know, yep, the lows were tough and you're questioning a lot of things. But equally, that's where it comes back to the resilience. You know, we've all suffered disappointment, whether it be as a player or a coach at some point. And again, that how you respond to it and how the players see you respond to it. Yeah, again, big learning curve.
And were you still playing, Neil, or did you step aside from the playing? And when you started taking the team, were you still playing?
So that was a discussion we had straight away, and they left it open, but they did feel that they were giving me the job to be the head coach, and they did say, you know, we want people to see you as the head coach. We think playing probably wouldn't be the best thing. And I can tell you, I got the job on Thursday morning, We trained on the Friday. We played on the Saturday, and quite quickly I realised that it was being possible. You know, the level I had to prepare at as a 34-year-old to perform at, I couldn't do as a coach, and I couldn't do the job properly. If I'd maybe been in an instance where I had an experienced assistant, I could have considered it short term. But I think it helped me a lot not playing, helped with the players that I wasn't playing as well, because, you know, I take my hat off to anyone that can do that successfully, but I didn't think that was a recipe for success.
Yeah, of course, identifying that as well must have been a big thing to actually say, right, I know you're thinking about the coaching, but as a player, it must have been still a tough decision to go, right, this is it, I need to hang the boots up here.
You know, again, I was so ready and so appreciative of this opportunity, and yeah. I know how hard it can be for coaches waiting on the right opportunity, and it wasn't one I expected to get at that moment in time. So in that respect, you know, as a player, I love playing, enjoyed every appearance that I made, a lot of pride in it, but again, I knew this was the next stage and the next step. So yeah. As much as it might seem like a difficult decision, I've got absolutely no regrets about it. And it was, again, I think knowing the club that I was going to, you know, manage for, that made it even easier. And, you know, I look back, I didn't have time to kind of sit back and think about my playing career. Maybe this period in time has allowed me to do that a little bit more. And I just think, you know, it's great, but not someone that, you know, defined by being a player. I think I was already moving on to that next stage, but trying to balance things outside of football. So, you know, I look back with a lot of fondness and pride in my playing career, but now fully focused on the coaching, and you know, that decision was made quickly, but it was sometimes the best ones are made quickly.
That's it, yeah, absolutely. Greg, I was going to just ask you a point that Neil touched on earlier, was with regards to, you know, that moment when he becomes head coach and he's got all of this on his plate to deal with. How do you go about preparing coaches for that moment when they're all of a sudden landed in that position where they've got everything to deal with? Do some just take it naturally, do you feel, or can you prepare as much as you can for that?
That's a PhD study, I think, to answer that question, Lewis. And that's, you know, it's interesting. There was a doctor I did some work with in my previous job in Ireland, and that's exactly what he was trying to do. He said, where was it that these guys were getting those kind of skills from? You know, where was that, you know, kind of, where were they pulling the experience from? Or they've not got the experience. Where are they pulling the knowledge from? Was it looking at players, or was it maybe picking up little nuggets of coach education? I think in terms of coach education, you know, coach education can only account, I think there was a recent article done maybe a year or so ago. I think coach education can only account for about 20% of that kind of experience, if you like, that Neil's got to go through. So yes, the theory's one side of things, the situations we're trying to replicate on the pitch and things like that are one thing, but the realities are completely different. You listen to Neil speaking there about the off-field instances. I can't say either. Neil couldn't say it. the off-field incidents that he had to deal with. You know, that's just, how can you do that in coach education? Yes, David Moyes is brilliant at it. David Moyes comes in religiously to speak on our pro licence and is brilliant at that. And he gives you all these off-field incidents. So how do you deal with this one and how do you deal with that one? And do you know what? Other than three or four guys sitting about in a kind of classroom situation, chatting about it, having time to come up with a decision, and then David Moyes turns to you and says, "Aye, that's all very well, but then the owner phoned me and told me to change my decision." So, you know, it's all these stuff. You can only prepare people so much, as I suppose, what I'm trying to say, Lewis.
Yeah, of course. And then, Neil, on you go.
I can give you, I think it's something that might give an insight, and here is a great story. Just carrying on from what Greg says there, because he's absolutely spot on. The coach education does a fantastic job. But again, there's so many facets to decision making that there's no kind of wrong or right decision. So I'm sitting at home one night and I get a phone call or a text from the physio to say, I've just had a text from our centre back to say he's not feeling great, he probably won't be able to train tomorrow. He had been under the weather and he played a game, feeling under the weather and did well. We had a big game coming up, And just at that, he happened to be in a local bar just after the text, bumping into the same athletic trainer that he'd text. And then he'd seen another member of staff later on at night in a nightclub. So straight away, I've got a decision to make here. Guy's not feeling great. I know that he's not been feeling the best, but he's also out at times he shouldn't be. But we have a big game coming up, and I need him. You know, he's a very unique type of player. So straight away, but people saying, oh, you can't play him. You know, he's done that. So I had to think about it. And again, I was like, okay, so as far as he's concerned, he doesn't know what I know. Yeah. So I played naive to the whole situation and told him to go home if he wasn't feeling great. You know, he arrived at training, said, look, Pat, if you don't feel great, why don't you go home? But then told my assistant to tell him that he knew he'd been out, because he knows people that are out. And, you know, the manager was trying to look after me, was unaware of it, but it was out of order. The big man then was like, oh, I'm so sorry, I'll stay and I'll train. He's like, no, look, go home, rest up, make sure you feel all right. Now, he played on the Wednesday night. We won 1-0 away to Nashville, which was a huge result, and he played fantastically well. Now, some people will say, because we won, we got it right, or did it set a bad tone for things in the future with other people? You don't know, but you're just trying to make the best of, you know, what you can, and that's where I suppose they call experience, isn't it? Trying to handle these situations and handle these people. And again, there is a short-term thing about winning, and then there's a long-term thing about culture and winning long-term, so... That was a situation that was very interesting.
It's fascinating as well, isn't it, Greg? Because, as you say, these are moments that you can't teach, really. You can't go through that in a book or presentation. You can listen to people, of course you can, but that could happen again to Neil, that very similar situation, and then he'll follow the same way he went last time, and it could go differently or it could go wrong, and you just
it could make a different decision as well, depending on the player that it was, and depending on maybe the information he's getting from the staff that he trusts. Yep. So, you know, it could the same thing could happen, well, God forbid, next weekend if we're all back playing football, and you know, he decides to make a different decision, and it's that intuition, I suppose. You know, and it probably doesn't come from a coach education course. Yes, we can chat about it, but it probably does come from Neil drawing on playing years of experience and knowing what's happening around the dressing room. But at the same time, being at that club himself and having that eyes and ears around the club, knowing what's happening and knowing and trusting his own intuition to make the best decision.
Having that intuition is something that will hopefully, as you say, stand you in good stead, Neil. But of course, as well, you sound like the type of guy that will always reflect and try to learn and develop yourself as you move on from something like that to something bigger, like a result or a performance or even a small section of a match where something maybe didn't go perfectly well. In your mind, you sound like you're always analysing your own performance.
Yeah, you know, of course. Again, now we're at a time where there's so much access to so much information, which is great. You know, so much stuff that you can use to learn and develop, and I think again, it's about finding a balance between, you know, analysing the things that you can improve, but not over analysing things that you can't affect. I think it's been great. One of the things that we've used, you know, a little bit more is like the data side of things, and the last 12 games of my first season in charge, just before I got the chance to catch up with Greg and Andy and Malky, you know, we performed really well. The results were, again, just okay. But again, spoke to someone that owns a data company that does all the football stuff, the high-end stuff, and they looked at it without watching the games and said, from what we see, if you perform the way you're performing, the results will come. And that's the way I felt. And just having those things to be able to, you know, the key performance indicators, and not, you know, again, it's as long as you're matching that up with what you're seeing, what your staff's seeing, what people are seeing, it's, you know, it's easier to analyse now than it's probably ever been, which has been a big help, and something that we're constantly trying to develop, especially with a style of play and all these things. And we all know that we're ultimately developed in one thing, and that's results. But again, we know that there's many things that go into that, and it's about the things that we can control, analysing them, and the things that you can't control. and doing that over a big period of time. And one thing I've realised again is you hear a lot of coaches ask for time, and I can see why, because, you know, again, short term ups and downs are going to happen whether you're good, bad or indifferent. But it's long term that you really want to be judged.
Yeah, absolutely. You must have something to add to that, Greg, and that point about seeing and obviously having the data behind it as well definitely helps, Neil, and that's a great point. But as a coach, believing in what you're doing and not just changing at the flip of a hat of maybe something that, you know, 2, 3, 4 bad results on the bounce, having that belief in your ability and your style as a coach must be a huge part.
I'm going to probably, you know, if you're asking me to comment on that, I'm going to probably call on the, you know, one of the, again, another recent podcast that we did with the, you know, Steve Salas. And Steve talked about, he spent a day with us and all the coach educators when the A-licence was cancelled. And he spoke to us that day about how do you know that you know? You know, how did Neil know that he was on the right track? How does he know? He knows. And, well, he's answered probably the question very well there. He's got a company in there that have analysed it further for him, and he's drawn on that, I suppose, again, to back up that intuition that he knew that he was on the right line. So how did he know? He knows was calling on that data. And it's interesting as well, isn't it? And that probably takes us into another area of conversation. It's like, how do you then trust your staff, and what kind of staff do you want? You know, if I don't know how Neil was offered the job at the club or offered the staff at the club. Did he inherit staff, and how was he able to put that team together to help him, I suppose, move forward in the right direction?
Yeah, so I did inherit. I inherited a goalkeeper coach / assistant coach, and then another assistant coach, a young American guy. So two guys that had been there under the previous coach. And I think when I took the job, you know, I said that I would give everyone an opportunity, but always wanted to be able to make changes if I felt it was necessary. But you say that to people and they always take that with a pinch of salt, that you're going to make these changes no matter what. But I genuinely believe it, because I've seen both instances, and I've seen very successful people come in, inherited staff, and then ended up developing long-term relationships with those guys. So funny enough, the goalkeeper coach is still on my staff to this day. We tried to keep the other member of staff, but he chose to go down a different path. So they both showed, you know, great strengths to me over that period of time. They were a great help. They were able to help with little logistical things that you might not have thought of as a young coach, their own experiences, and again, just be able to develop a rapport with them. On the other hand, I was able to bring someone else in that I wanted. So I really had a great mix, a great blend of people that I hadn't previously worked with and people that, you know, I did have relationships with. And again, there's probably no right or wrong way, but I have seen, you know, people work with people that are already in the position. And I think if you give people an opportunity, then's the best time to make the decision, as opposed to having preconceived ideas. Mm-hmm. Because I think when you've got guys that are desperate to be successful and desperate to help, you know, that if they've got those two things, then you've got to give them an opportunity, and who knows what might happen.
Yeah, that is one of the big things for a manager. And I know that, again, it is probably an obvious thing to say, but surrounding yourself with not necessarily just the right people, but the right type of people, isn't it, Greg? And being able to have an eye for that is huge.
Absolutely, it is. And there's just so many. Again, there's no right way either, Lewis. You know, there's just so many different stories. You know, you think of Ian Cathro, for example, who bumped into Nuno on his A licence and all of a sudden ends up, you know, as Nuno's kind of trusted lieutenant for a while, if you like. Yeah. You know, relationships can develop that way. Relationships can develop the way Neil was just described, by, you know, him essentially inheriting staff that he eventually develops a bond with and probably would like to have worked with longer period if he could have, in the case of the fella leaving him. So, you know, they develop in different ways, and again, it's Neil probably puts it quite simply, but it's about man management as well. You know, he talks highly of the two guys helping him there, but, you know, I'm sure they'll both say that Neil's helped them, and his man management skills as well have got to come to the fore, not just for the players, but also for that backroom staff. So, you know, there's a lot going on in that young career as a coach as soon as you get that job.
Yeah. Now, I'm conscious of you two having kids running riot around your houses, so I'm going to move on to just a kind of closing section, if you like, Neil. I want to just kind of touch on the next steps for you in your coaching journey. It's all obviously about aspirations. You can't predict the future, particularly at the moment with this pandemic that we're in. But the next steps for you, it'd be great to hear from you and what your aspirations are.
I think no different to anything else I've done in my life, whether it be, you know, my playing career, that bit. I'm hugely ambitious, and it's how to, you know, how to manage that ambition. And right now I know that I'm in a fantastic role, a role that, again, I never take for granted. And I think that every day I'm working, I'm getting better in experience. You know, this thing, experience, it's just dealing with those situations. It's dealing with the phone going and a player's injured, and dealing with the phone going and someone that you built your team around ill or wants to leave and club wants to buy a player. These are things that you can't practice for. You've got to be in the job to get that experience. So I'm very happy where I am. I'm trying to build something that I can point towards as a kind of body of work that people can say that that's the impact you can have. And longer term, who knows where that will take me. Again, just probably like playing, and just feel if you're doing the right things, you know, the phone rings and someone asks, you know, and I want to coach at as high a level as I possibly can. But the big thing is I just enjoy coaching. I was coaching young kids prior to taking the job. I was coaching your teenage kids, and I enjoyed that as well. The professional game's where I want to be, but I think my wife's very well aware that being in professional sport, being in professional football, it's you know, sporadic. It can be volatile, and we know that. And I'm loving it in Florida, but it's a big world out there with football played all over. So we're not going to pigeonhole ourselves and just see what opportunities come.
And you had a great season. You went on a fantastic run, Neil. Did you not break records and stuff for the kind of unbeaten run you were on last year?
Yeah, like last season was in some respects, you know, excellent. We went on the longest unbeaten run. We finished, I think, 13 games. First 13 games unbeaten. I think we lost one in the first 20 games. We broke clean sheet records, goals scored, away wins. But then ultimately, I feel we were a very tight league, and we ended up probably the last third of the season was more disappointing. So again, you take it, you know, so many positives, but equally, you know, feel it was a chance lost. You know, but again, you know, felt starting this season, again, we were better, you know, recruited better, improved on last year. So I think in the period I've been in the job, 18 months, you know, closing on 20 months, we've made big changes. We've had young players. We've, you know, all these things that don't equate to maybe results. But, you know, the fact that we've had the youngest player in history make his debut, 18-year-old from Sheffield United on loan. We had another player in Norwich City on loan, young player. We had two academy players make their debuts for the club. We've signed four players' academy contracts. So these are other things that, again, when you talk about time, you know, we've tried to open up to the community, show young players in the Tampa Bay area that there is a pathway for them. Because again, these are things that are not related to winning, but I think are important for a club like Tampa that they show. And that's part of my job is to build those opportunities so that we can get even more people involved in the club. The fans buy into that. Fans buy into it. And that has a direct impact on the team. So these are all the things that people don't see that we're trying to do. And that's what I'm excited about as well when I talk about building longer term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, those values that you speak about there, just sum up and go back to the point we were talking about earlier when you were initially offered that job, that, you know, people up at board level must have seen, and you've taken on those qualities and really seem to just be a perfect fit for the club at the moment and must be excited for football to return in general.
So, you know, so excited. I mean, I never take for granted how much I love football, but I think we all now, just if there was a game, you know, on the TV, we'd all be tuning in no matter who it was playing. And then when we get back to training, I think players, coaches, we're all going to have a renewed sense of purpose, because we'll realise just how much we enjoy it. And I think being with people, you know, I think that's what it comes out. The biggest thing for my playing career was the people I met and the experience I shared with these people. And that's, again, where we're at now. We just all want to get back and start doing things together. And sharing training sessions, sharing games, sharing the highs, sharing the lows. We'll all appreciate that the lows are not quite as bad as we thought, you know, so desperate to get back and back to work.
That's all we have time for in this week's edition of the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast. Feel free to send us your feedback, your ideas for coaching topics you want us to cover, and to get in touch, visit @ScottishFA on Twitter or email info@scottishfa.co.uk.